Chapter 32. The shooting script was now ready. Marina, in Dorian robe and coolie hat, reclined reading in a long chair on the patio. Her director, G.A. Vronsky, elderly, bald-headed, with a spread of grizzled fur on his fat chest, was alternately sipping his vodka and tonic and feeding Marina typewritten pages from a folder. On her other side, cross-legged on a mat, sat Pedro, surname unknown, stage name forgotten, a repulsively handsome, practically naked young actor with satyr ears, slanty eyes, and lynx nostrils, whom she had brought from Mexico and was keeping at a hotel in Lodore. Ada, lying on the edge of the swimming pool, was doing her best to make the shy Dackel face the camera in a reasonably upright and decent position, while Philip Rack, an insignificant but on the whole likable young musician, who in his baggy trunks looked even more dejected and awkward than in the green velvet suit he thought fit to wear for the piano lessons he gave Lucette, was trying to take a picture of the recalcitrant chop-licking animal and of the girl's parted breasts, which her half-prone position helped to disclose in the opening of her bathing suit. If one dollied now to another group standing a few paces away under the purple garlands of the patio arch, one might take a medium shot of the young maestro's pregnant wife in a polka-dotted dress replenishing goblets with salted almonds, and of our distinguished lady novelist resplendent in mauve flounces, mauve hat, mauve shoes, pressing a zebra vest on Lucette, who kept rejecting it with rude remarks, learned from a maid, but uttered in a tone of voice just beyond deafish Mademoiselle La Riviere's field of hearing. Lucette remained topless. Her tight, smooth skin was the color of thick peach syrup. Her little crupper in willow-green shorts rolled drolly. The sun lay sleek on her russet bob and plumpish torso. It showed but a faint circumlocution of femininity, and Vaughn, in a scowling mood, recalled with mixed feelings how much more developed her sister had been at not quite 12 years of age. He had spent most of the day fast asleep in his room, and a long, rambling, dreary dream had repeated in a kind of pointless parody his strenuous, Casanovanic night with Ada, and that somehow ominous morning talk with her. Now that I am writing this, after so many hollows and heights of time, I find it not easy to separate our conversation, as set down in an inevitably stylized form, and the drone of complaints, turning on sordid betrayals that obsessed young Vaughn in his dull nightmare. Or was he dreaming now that he had been dreaming? Had a grotesque governess really written a novel entitled Les Enfants Maudits, to be filmed by frivolous dummies, now discussing its adaptation? To be made even triter than the original Book of the Fortnight and its gurgling blurbs? Did he detest Ada as he had in his dream? He did. Now, at 15, she was an irritating and hopeless beauty, a rather unkempt one, too. Only 12 hours ago, in the dim tool room, he had whispered a riddle in her ear. What begins with a duh? And rhymes more or less with a Silesian river ant. She was eccentric in habits and clothing. She cared nothing for sunbathing, and not a tinge of the tan that had Californized Lucette could be traced on the shameless white of Ada's long limbs and scrawny shoulder blades. A remote cousin, no longer Renee's sister, not even his half-sister, so lyrically anathematized by Montparnasse, she stepped over him as over a log, and returned the embarrassed dog to Marina. The actor, who quite likely would run into somebody's fist in a forthcoming scene, made a filthy remark in broken French. Du sollst nicht zu horen? Murmured Ada to German Dack before putting him back in Marina's lap under the accursed children.
On ne parle pas comme ça devant un chien, added Ada, not deigning to glance at Pedro, who nevertheless got up,
reconstructed his crotch, and beat her to the pool with a Nijinsky leap. Was she really beautiful? Was she at least what they call attractive? She was exasperation. She was torture.
The silly girl had heaped her hair under a rubber cap, and this gave an unfamiliar, vaguely clinical look to her neck, with its odd dark wisps and strags, as if she had obtained a nurse's job and would never dance again. Her faded bluish-gray one-piece swimsuit had a spot of grease and a hole above one hip, nibbled through, one might conjecture, by a tallow-starved larva, and seemed much too short for careless comfort. She smelled of damp cotton, axillary tufts, and nenuphars, like mad Ophelia. None of those minor matters would have annoyed Vaughn had she and he been alone together, but the presence of the all-male actor made everything obscene, drab, and insupportable. We move back to the lip of the pool. Our young man, being exceptionally brižgliv, squeamish, easily disgusted, had no desire to share a few cubic meters of chlorinated Celestino, blues your bath, with two other fellows. He was emphatically not Japanese. He always remembered, with shudders of revulsion, the indoor pool of his prep school, the running noses, the pimpled chests, the chance contacts with odious male flesh, the suspicious bubble bursting like a small stink bomb, and especially, the bland, sly, triumphant, and absolutely revolting wretch who stood in shoulder-high water and secretly urinated. And God, how he had beaten him up, though that Vere de Vere was 3 years older than he. And now he kept carefully out of reach of any possible splash as Pedro and Phil snorted and fooled in their foul bath. Presently the pianist, floating up and showing his awful gums in a servile grin, tried to draw Ada into the pool from her outstretched position on the tiled margin, but she evaded the grab of his despair by embracing the big orange ball she had just fished out, and, pushing him away with that shield, she then threw it toward Vaughn, who slapped it aside, refusing the gambit, ignoring the gamble, scorning the gambler. And now Harry Pedro hoisted himself onto the brink and began to flirt with the miserable girl. His banal attentions were really the least of her troubles.
"Your little aperture must be raccommodated," he said.
"Que voulez-vous dire, for goodness' sake?" she asked, instead of dealing him a backhanded wallop.
"Permit that I contact your charming pentatrillium,"
the idiot insisted, and put a wet finger on the hole in her swimsuit.
"Oh, that!"
Shrugging and rearranging the shoulder strap displaced by the shrug.
"Never mind that. Next time, maybe, I'll put on my fabulous new bikini."
"Next time, maybe, no, Pedro?"
"Too bad," said Ada. "Now go and fetch me a Coke, like a good dog."
"Et tu?"
Pedro asked Marina as he walked past her chair.
"Again, screwdriver?"
"Yes, dear, but with grapefruit, not orange, and a little zucchero." "I can't understand," turning to Vronsky. "Why do I sound 100 years old on this page and 15 on the next? Because if it is a fleshbeck, and it is a fleshbeck, I suppose."
She pronounced it fleshbeck.
"Rennie, or what's his name, Rene, should not know what he seems to know."
"He does not," cried G.A. "It's only a half-hearted fleshbeck. Anyway, this Rennie, this lover number one, does not know, of course, that she is trying to get rid of lover number two, while she's wondering all the time if she can dare go on dating number three, the gentleman farmer, see?"
"Nu, eto chitoto slojnovato."
"Sort of complicated, Grigory Akimovich," said Marina, scratching her cheek, for she always tended to discount, out of sheer self-preservation, the considerably more shlozhny patterns of her own past.
"Read on, read. It all becomes clear," said G.A., riffling through his own copy.
"Incidentally," observed Marina, "I hope dear Ida will not object to our making him not only a poet, but a ballet dancer. Pedro could do that beautifully, but he can't be made to recite French poetry."
"If she protests," said Vronsky, "she can go and stick a telegraph pole
where it belongs. The indecent telegraph caused Marina, who had a secret fondness for salty jokes, to collapse in otter-like ripples of rolling laughter.
Покатившись со смеху врода Ады.
But let's be serious. I still don't see how and why his wife, I mean the second guy's wife, accepts the situation. Положение.
Вронский spread his fingers and toes.
Причем тут положение?
Situation, situation.
She is blissfully ignorant of their affair, and besides, she knows she is fubsy and frumpy and simply cannot compete with dashing Hélène.
I see, but some won't, said Marina.
In the meantime, Herr Rock swam up again and joined Ada on the edge of the pool, almost losing his baggy trunks in the process of an amphibious heave.
Permit me, Ivan, to get you also a nice cold Russian cock, said Pedro,
really a very gentle and amiable youth at heart.
Get yourself a coconut, replied nasty Ivan,
testing the poor fawn, who did not get it in any sense, and, giggling pleasantly, went back to his mat. Claudius, at least, did not court Ophelia. The melancholy young German was in a philosophical mood shading into the suicidal. He had to return to Calugano with his Elsie, who, Doc Exrecker thought,
would present him with driplets in dry weeks.
He hated Calugano, his and her hometown, where in a moment of mutual aberration, stupid Elsie had given him her all on a park bench after a wonderful office party at Muzikovsky's organs, where the oversexed, pitiful oaf had a good job.
When are you leaving?
Asked Ada.
First day, after tomorrow.
Fine, that's fine. Adieu, Mr. Rack.
Poor Philip drooped, finger-painting sad nothings on wet stone, shaking his heavy head, gulping visibly.
One feels, he said, that one is merely playing a role and has forgotten the next speech.
I'm told many feel that, said Ada. It must be a furchtbar feeling.
Cannot be helped? No hope any more at all? I am dying, yes?
You are dead,
Mr. Rack, said Ada. She had been casting sidelong glances during that dreadful talk, and now saw pure, fierce Vaughn under the tulip tree, quite a way off, one hand on his hip, head thrown back, drinking beer from a bottle. She left the pool edge with its corpse and moved toward the tulip tree, making a strategic detour between the authoress, who, still unaware of what they were doing to her novel, was dozing in a deck chair, out of whose wooden arms her chubby fingers grew like pink mushrooms, and the leading lady, now puzzling over a love scene where the young Chatelaine's radiant beauty was mentioned.
But, said Marina, how can one act out radiant? What does radiant beauty mean?
Pale beauty,
said Pedro helpfully, glancing up at Ada as she passed by.
The beauty for which many men would cut off their members.
Okay, said Vronsky. Let us get on with this damned script. He leaves the poolside patio, and since we contemplate doing it in color...
Vaughn left the poolside patio and strode away. He turned into a side gallery that led into a grovey part of the garden, grading insensibly into the park proper. Presently, he noticed that Ada had hastened to follow him. Lifting one elbow, revealing the black star of her armpit, she tore off her bathing cap and, with a shake of her head, liberated a torrent of hair. Lucette, in color, trotted behind her. Out of charity for the sister's bare feet, Vaughn changed his course from gravel path to velvet lawn, reversing the action of Dr. Uro, pursued by the invisible albino in one of the greatest novels of English literature. They caught up with him in the second coppice. Lucette, in passing, stopped to pick up her sister's cap and sunglasses, the sunglasses of much-sung lasses, ashamed to throw them away. My tidy little Lucette, I shall never forget you. placed both objects on a tree stump near an empty beer bottle, trotted on, then went back to examine a bunch of pink mushrooms that clung to the stump, snoring. Double take. Double exposure.
"Are you furious because—"
began Ada upon overtaking him. She had prepared a sentence about her having to be polite after all to a piano tuner, practically a servant, with an obscure heart ailment and a vulgar, pathetic wife, but Van interrupted her.
"I object," he said, expelling it like a rocket, "to two things. A brunette, even a sloppy brunette, should shave her groin before exposing it. And a well-bred girl does not allow a beastly lecher to poke her in the ribs, even if she must wear a moth-eaten smelly rag, much too short for her charms. Ach," he added, "why the hell did I return to Ardis? I promise to be more careful from now on and not let lousy Pedro come near," she said with happy, rigorous nods and an exhalation of glorious relief, the cause of which was to torture Van only much later.
"Oh, wait for me,"
yelped Lucette. "Torture, my poor love. Torture. Yes, but it's all sunk and dead." Ada's late note. The three of them formed a pretty Arcadian combination as they dropped on the turf under the great weeping cedar, whose aberrant limbs extended an oriental canopy, propped up here and there by crutches made of its own flesh, like this book, above two black and one golden-red head, as they had above you and me on dark, warm nights when we were reckless, happy children. Van, sprawling supine, sick with memories, put his hands behind his nape and slit his eyes at the Lebanese blue of the sky, between the fascicles of the foliage. Lucette fondly admired his long lashes while pitying his tender skin for the inflamed blotches and prickles between neck and jaw, where shaving caused the most trouble. Ada, her keepsake profile inclined, her mournful Magdalene hair hanging down in sympathy with the weeping shadows along her pale arm, sat examining abstractly the yellow throat of a waxy white helleborine she had picked. She hated him. She adored him. He was brutal. She was defenseless. Lucette, always playing her part of the clinging, affectionately fussy lassie, placed both palms on Van's hairy chest and wanted to know why he was cross. "I'm not cross with you," replied Van at last. Lucette kissed his hand, then attacked him.
"Cut it out," he said as she wriggled against his bare thorax. "You're unpleasantly cold, child." "It's not true. I'm hot," she retorted.
"Cold as two halves of a canned peach. Now roll off, please."
"Why two? Why? Yes, why?"
growled Ada with a shiver of pleasure and, leaning over, kissed him on the mouth. He struggled to rise. The two girls were now kissing him alternately, then kissing each other, then getting busy upon him again, Ada in perilous silence, Lucette with soft squeals of delight. I do not remember what les enfants maudits did or said in Montparnasse's novelette. They lived in Bryant's chateau, I think, and it began with bats flying one by one out of a turret's œil de bœuf into the sunset. But these children, whom the novelettist did not really know, a delicious point, might also have been filmed rather entertainingly had Snoopy Kim, the kitchen photo fiend, possessed the necessary apparatus. One hates to write about those matters. It all comes out so improper, aesthetically speaking, in written description. But one cannot help recalling in this ultimate twilight, where minor artistic blunders are fainter than very fugitive bats in an insect-poor wilderness of orange air, that Lucette's dewy little contributions augmented rather than dampened Van's invariable reaction to the only and main girl's lightest touch, actual or imagined. Ada, her silky mane sweeping over his nipples and navel, seemed to enjoy doing everything to jolt my present pencil and make, in that ridiculously remote past, her innocent little sister notice and register what Van could not control. The crushed flower was now being merrily crammed under the rubber belt of his black trunks by 20 tickly fingers. As an ornament, it had not much value. As a game, it was inept and dangerous. He shook off his pretty tormentors and walked away on his hands, a black mask over his carnival nose. Just then, the governess, panting and shouting, arrived on the scene.
Mais qu'est-ce qu'il t'a fait, ton cousin? She kept anxiously asking, as Lucette, shedding the same completely unwarranted tears that Ada had once shed, rushed into the mauve-winged arms.